Okay, let the vertoning begin. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Harry Kelmer. This is John Hunt. I've known John for many, many years. We met each other in advertising when I worked for him. Yeah, so we've come a long way, and we've also had these parallel careers on other levels. John is also a playwright, as you know, and he's also a novelist. And which sort of leads to my first question to John, and it's just before the mics were turned on, we were talking about our old friend, J.M. Coetzee, and I always get this quote wrong, so I'm going to read it from my phone. But I think in the context of this discussion, it is quite pertinent. And that is the famous James Goodseer quote that's so well known, and that's why I'm reading it here, because you'll all correct me on the way. All autobiography is storytelling. All writing is autobiography. John, do you agree with Goodseer on that?
Tough first question. Well, thank you, Harry. Probably 90%, and it's very difficult, I think, to write if you're not referencing something inside you, and I think various authors have various ways of camouflaging that, mm-hmm. and various ways of being very open about it. And I suppose I'm guilty of exactly that in the book, because I was brought up in Hillbrow. The book has many, many parts that are absolutely true factually to my upbringing in the Bronx in the 60s. But then it moves around a little bit, and certain things are changed. Some, I don't know, maybe I'm just a bit sensitive about things, but most of those, I would suspect, the stranger things are true, and the more benign things I've changed. I have, for example, a sister who doesn't appear in the book, but I didn't want to put her in because it just seemed to complicate the plot. But most of the questions that people ask me afterwards is, was that part of the truth, or was that one of the things you made up? They normally get those wrong. Does that answer your question?
No, it does, up to a point. Well, this is the actual truth about John that I'm about to share with you. John is the author of the novel The Space Between the Space, his book The Art of the Idea, which celebrates the power of ideas to move the world forward, has been translated into several languages. He is currently worldwide creative chair of advertising agency network TBWA, having previously co-founded TBWA and Tlaskaras. He grew up in Hillbrow, and he still lives and works in Johannesburg. So, yes, so that sort of answers the question, I suppose. And the other thing is, of course, Fenn is this delightful, is it 10, 9, 11?
Yeah. 11.
The delightful character who lives in Hillbrow, and he lives in this wonderful world of his own. And it is just, how autobiographical is that? You know, that boy, how much of the young John is in that Fenn?
That's quite autobiographical. But again, not entirely, so I'm dyslexic, as he was, but I never stuttered, mm-hmm. as he does very badly. But I disappeared into books, mm-hmm. Very much the way mm-hmm. he did. So much of the arc of the story from his eyes is pretty accurate.
Mm-hmm. So talking about dyslexia and stuttering, the reason why I link the two is like, two of my favorite authors suffer from those two conditions. And the one being, which I still find incredible after knowing it for 30 years, is John Irving, who's dyslexic. And the other one, of course, is Updike, with his incredible stutter. And, you know, I think how does things like that, how does it turn one into a writer? How does it impact on your writer? Do you think if one is able to read or able to walk into a room with confidence and able to speak without a stutter, do you think you may not become a writer?
I'm honestly not sure how it works, but I think for me, the fact that I often was mocked a little bit because I couldn't spell properly and those sort of things. But when you write, you can correct. It's your time. You can look, you can tell the story. So there's not that present momentness about it. And when you, even as a kid, when you're writing stories, it's in your own space. And in a way, who cares if you're making spelling mistakes or getting things wrong? So I think for me, writing became a bit of a sort of escape hole from the literalness of spelling and making those mistakes. Stutterers, I think, might have that same sense of if you write the word, you don't have to go through the verbalizing it. And that kind of maybe gives you a bit of confidence.
I think what is interesting for me in the character Fenn is like, if you describe him theoretically, you know, sort of, if you talk about Fenn as a character, he could easily become a caricature, and yet he doesn't. He is this warm and lovely, wonderful child or boy that you really, really like. And one of the things that I like about, or what I think why the character actually works, is the fact that you surround him with other very real and warm characters, you know. And what is interesting for me, and it may sound weird to you as an English-speaking South African, is like you depict a world that isn't that well known.
Yeah.
The world of our parents, the Anglo-Saxon world. When people write about Joburg, they write about sort of working class English, or they write about Afrikaners, or they write about Jewish families or Indian families, and yet the WASP, no disrespect intended, but that world is not very widely depicted South African literature, and so I think that adds to the charm. And the other thing is the characters are so real, as I said, and the other thing is the sense of place. The sense of place is incredibly real. I actually ended up in Berea, or Hillbrow, I suppose, where a lot of the action takes place. And the sense of place is so real. How did you go about recreating that space? How did you find that space? Did you look at photographs? Is it memory? How did you do it?
All of the above. Quite interestingly, I can remember that time much more vividly than I can, you know, last week. So somehow, maybe because of that moment in my life, it's very, very vividly etched in my mind. I think it was, in retrospect, a very unique time for Hillbrow, which I didn't understand, obviously, at the time. But Hillbrow was this crazy place, you know. We see it now as, you know, drug land or Nigerians with bad sunglasses doing drugs and all that sort of thing. Hillbrow at that stage was so cosmopolitan. Greeks, Italians, Portuguese, WASP. It was the most cosmopolitan part of South Africa. And we lived a very vibrant life that a lot of people battle to understand now. So I think that also helped just keep it very, very fresh in my mind. I have good memories of the way everyone shared things. I did, before I wrote the book, spend a day with the camera going through Hillbrow and taking pictures. And some things just, you know, you take one photograph where I went past Duchess Court, it's still there. The palm tree in front of my building is still there. So there are a lot of very alive things in the... But, of course, it isn't the same, Hillbrow. I was with my daughter, and she took a picture of one of the buildings, and a gentleman came up and asked if she would mind deleting it because as he said, I'm a drug dealer, I would prefer you not to take a picture. Okay, and we deleted it. So, you know, I'm not saying it's, I want to be overly nostalgic, it's a changed place, but it's still very vibrant, it's community driven. I never, during the day, felt threatened. So it's a, I think it also helps that the place is still alive, keeps you in your memory because those buildings are there, but the sense of vibrancy in its changed way is also still there.
You know, it's interesting. Wesuma Bali, the Zulu copywriter that you also knew, when she bought Scandalo in Rocky Street, she invited Sampat and myself there. And I said to her, are Sampat and I going to be the only whiteys in the room? And she said, and she thought about it, and she said, yes, probably. Yep. And I said, you know, Sue, we're not going to do it. And she said, yes, it's not your place anymore. And I still live two blocks, three doors down from where I lived in Yeovil. I live in Observatory now. But that sense of, like, it's not my place anymore. And yet when I go through there on a right morning, on the wrong morning, it feels like I'm in sort of Beirut 1982. But on the right morning, it is quite a wonderful place. You know, I can just see, you know, it's just not little guys going down to the school anymore. It's now little Nigerian guys. It's not little Jewish guys going down. It's, you know, it's little Nigerian guys or little Zimbabwean guys. So it's that change. It's an interesting observation that you make, you know. That.
And I think it's one of the uniquenesses of South Africa. It's so, not one is better than the other. It's just, there it is. And this has happened in a relatively short space of time. So, you know, some people will think Hillbrow or places like Yeovil have demised. Other people say it's a celebration because it was so terrible beforehand. Because it's also important to understand that, you know, Hillbrow in the 60s was, although in of itself it was very cosmopolitan and, you know, people were giving peace signs to everyone, it was still in the middle of a very closed, horrible net of apartheid that was getting closer and closer. So, yeah, it's very difficult to have one kind of comment that just sums everything up. It's, everything's got its nuance.
I know. It's interesting because one of the, they asked me to teach a course at Wits, if I would be willing to teach a course at Wits called Writing the City, and specifically writing Joburg. And one of the things that I will do is I will put this book next to Room 206 and Hillbrow, Our Hillbrow, and see how the Hillbrow of the 90s and noughties compares to the Hillbrow of the 60s and the 70s. And I'm sure that you'll find things are quite different, but yet they're still the same. The sense of community. You have a huge sense of community, even though you see yourself as an outsider.
Yeah.
Freudian slip. Fenn sees himself in as an outsider. He has a sense of community, though the wonderful characters in the book,
yeah,
in the apartment block, in the block of flats, the Lebs down the road, the little boy, where does he come from? Does he come?
The Greek guy.
Yeah, the Greek guy. You know, so he has a sense of community and belonging. So it would be interesting. I'm sure that sort of sense of community still survives.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And the other thing that adds a whole lot to me to the book is the spirit of, I mean, spirit of place, as Durrell calls it, is wonderful. But then you never fall into local color. You never sort of like write about the quaintness of the place and create a sort of a quaint touristic local color thing. And the result of that is that the book is not nostalgic. It does not build on regret and what has gone past and, oh, wasn't that the good old Joburg that we all knew and love. It is a celebration of a time, and yet there is not a yearning back to it. How did you do that? Did you consciously do that? Did you set out to...
There were two issues that worried me about the book. The first is I didn't want it to be mawkish because it was, you know, 11-year-old going through tough times, and I didn't want it to be sentimental, so I was very aware of that potential danger. And the other was, although Hillbrow at that time was unique and amazing and had all these terrific, in a visceral and an abstract quality, it was nothing like anywhere else in South Africa. People would drive in from Vereeniging and Vanderbijl Park and wind up their windows and, you know, look at the crazies and be able to go home and say, I drove through Hillbrow, you know, so and survive. So it was unique, but I also had to be aware it was just a tiny pin in a horrible South Africa that was slowly getting more and more conservative. You know, if you weren't a white person in Hillbrow, just outside, was pretty terrible. So I didn't want it to become as if this was a Camelot. For me, as a little boy, it had unique wonders, but I didn't want it to be put up as, you know, oh, if only we could go back here, everything was perfect.
I think the other thing that's also interesting in that sort of what I just mentioned about spirit plays is the spirit of the objects in the boy's life. You know, is his grandfather's watch, the ugly painting of the clown, right? That, and then the radio, and the tape recorder. And this is a bit of a curveball, maybe, but I just wondered yesterday, this morning, when I looked at page 68 again. I just want to read you this thing. It's a lovely little scene. it was the uncle. He brings a tape recorder to the house or to the flat where Fenn's very ill dad is still around, and he records them. And the father and his uncle says, "So posh, say something. I am trying to record your voice." It was their voices, but it was not then. Fenn marveled at the mystery of it all. Everyone seemed delirious. His mother giggled incessantly while trying to wipe away the tears from her eyes. His father's body shook as his pajamas ballooned with his clutching, with his chuckling. Fenn wondered if his father, bloated with laughter, might lift off the bed and float towards the ceiling. Each time his heaving chest tried to catch his breath, he let out a loud snort and triggered the whole room again. Uncle Ed paced the room, eventually seeking refuge behind the oxygen cylinder, where he cackled and guffawed in the corner. The room had never been so happy. The magic box had turned a dark cell smelling of hospital into an enhanced place by merrily playing their own voices back to them. And this scene, I now realize, rereading it out loud, it contains one of the elements of this book that I'll dwell on a bit more later. But the reason why I'm reading this is, when we were young writers, John was very famous for being a very good radio writer. Even though TV was the sexy new girl on the block in the mid-80s, John was still out there writing very good radio. And the importance of this scene and the importance of Springbok Radio, how did that impact on young John? Yeah. I mean, this is an unfair question, but I just wondered that sense of magic that you describe here, was that a part of your inspiration for writing good radio?
I think so. The tape recorder, see, is completely true. So, really? Again, I remember it very viscerally. There was an organization called Tape Aids for the Blind. So if you were blind, you had poor sight, you could get all these wonderful stories. If you had a tape recorder, they'd drop off these reel-to-reels for people. It was a wonderful organization. So I could literally sit with my father and hear a story. And remember, this is an age, no Facebook, there's no Instagram, no internet, no any. So radio or audio was our most provocative, interesting medium. And unlike cinema and then later TV, with radio, you're the third person in the room, or the second person in the room, however you want to see it. So you'd hear a story, and then you'd imagine what the characters looked like. Or you would, they told you, like in the book, they reference, you know, Southwest Africa, the deserts of Southwest. I could imagine the deserts of Southwest Africa. I wasn't being shown them on TV or whatever. So I think audio, radio, listening to those books allowed you to participate very, very differently. So later on, when I ended up having to, you know, write radio, I loved it because it sparked off all those deep memories. But for me, it was one of the more, and still is the more magical media, because you're a copywriter, you're a script writer, you're whatever, and you're putting words down, and other people are adding their imagination to it. So it's a different, very specific medium.
I think what is nice about that, what you were saying now, other people bring their interpretation to the words, is you're also a theater maker like myself. And that is one of the great joys of for a novelist or a short story writer to actually go into the theater and have all this. You have set designers coming to the party, the actors bringing their part, the director bringing their part, the audience bringing their part. So it's much more sociable or social skill than sitting down and writing novels. And yet you seem to be writing more and more novels rather than theater. Was that a conscious decision? Or
funny enough, yes, and for exactly the reason that I now prefer being locked in a room and doing it myself. Not that I don't mind being sociable and sharing, but I think maybe I'm just at a moment in my life where I feel that's how I want to say things, rather than through theater or TV or whatever. So I guess you go through different phases, but it feels like you have more control. If you have an idea and you want to articulate it, you have fewer people putting their all in, although of course you have editors and good people that help you make it better. But I think it's a different, I just feel right now that's what I want to write.
But you're also a very instinctive storyteller. I remember when we worked on TV, you could walk into an offline edit and say, do this, do this, do that, and the story would actually fall together. So how far, when you write, I mean, there's no such thing as fast writing, but in terms of structure and that, how quickly do those things fall into place for you?
Counterintuitively, not so quick. Well, no. The structure falls in, but the filling of the story to it, I do it again and I do it again. Before, I don't do one draft. I do chapter one. Oh, I don't like chapter one. Go back on chapter two. So, strangely enough, I'm a bit of a pain in the butt in terms of very slow starter, and then as I get halfway, it seems to pick up, because I like to think the first draft is not done, is pretty much in place.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of working. I know other writers also work that way, whereas myself, you know, I'm just like sort of what Natalie Goldberg says, or laying down the tracks. You just put down your tracks and you just can come back and pick it up again. So it's quite interesting to... I know James Wiley, the South African historical novelist, also works like that. He like literally almost finishes chapter for chapter for chapter for chapter. So that's very... Yeah.
Too anal.
Yeah. Which sort of informs, you know, another point about writing is a lot of books are built on other books. And like Fenn spent an enormous amount of time in his father's room reading these books to his father and sharing this thing. Are there any books that informed this book, that made this book what it is?
I don't think as informing the book in a literal sense, but absolutely in a broader sense. So, because my father was ill, from about 9, I was reading him his books. So often I didn't understand them, and often I'd have to ask how to pronounce this word or whatever. But I would sort of get the gist of it, and whether it was a spy novel or whatever of that era. So the books referred to in Fenn were the books of that era and were very typical of what I would read to my father. So sometimes you read And I reference in the book, you know, my dad would just like hearing words, I guess, like when you turn a radio down low, you just, the mumble gives you a kind of comfort. And then sometimes he'd be very, you know, specific about you pronouncing that word incorrectly, or, you know, didn't help always with my dyslexia. So in that sense, all those books informed the book. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. Now, when I read this book, just to give you a bit of context, I read this book, I spent some time in Denmark in 2018, last year. And while I was there, I received a copy of this book and I read it because we did the launch in Joburg. And the book just totally transported me. And I think that is one of the magical things in the book. And to those of you who've read the book, will know what I'm talking about. And to those of the thing that springs into mind the moment you start reading certain scenes in the book, you start thinking, wow, this is magic realism. And because it becomes totally sort of almost surreal, but with a little silver glow around it. Tell me about that. How did that happen? The most obvious scene in the book is a scene in a park in Hillbrow. I assume it's at Nugget Hill or down there, where this lady's feeding the birds, and it just becomes like this magical moment, right? And then as the story progresses, it becomes even more magical. Tell me about the magic that you found in the everyday in this book.
Well, I think there is magic everywhere. So I think often it's to be found as opposed to, or to be noticed and seen and acknowledged rather than to be invented. I'll give you a classic example. I flew down to Cape Town this morning. There was a man in front of me with a check under his arm. It was for 10,000 rand. You know, when you win a golf day or something, I don't know, those big... He's walking around with a 1 meter large check under his arm. I mean, and you could see when he got to the... You know, where is he going to put this check? He's flying, you know, and you could see the ground staff sort of... and he's not going to get rid of this check. Now, that's magic realism, but it's you know what I mean? Where on earth, what is the story there? But if you wrote it, you'd almost think, well, someone, you know, John had too much wine last night and he's kind of made this thing up. But I think life is full of these things, and you just have to be open to observe them, and the magic pours out. So I think a lot of it is observed reality, and then sometimes the observer or the author can step back a bit and contextualize it or play with it a little bit. But there's no shortage of magic in the world. I think it's just we are so processed and we are so pushed to almost turn full color into black and white, as opposed to the other way around.
Yeah, I think that the realization that I came to at the end of the book was, it's actually not magical realism. It is realistic magic. Yeah. It's the book does exactly what John described now. He finds this moment. There's a scene at the end of the book where this young child climbs to the top of a building under construction. And it's the most beautiful sort of lyrical, magical description of Joburg at night. And yet it is real. It becomes magical, but yet it is totally based in the reality of this little 11-year-old's world. And that I found totally fascinating. And those of you who haven't read the book, that is the one thing that makes this book really, really exceptional in what, you know, what is around in South African writing at the moment. I just find it so refreshing. Now, words, stories, books, each title of the chapters of the books have like a little name. It's each is a word, the title. How important are words to you? How important are stories to you? How important are books to you?
I think, given the nature of the book specifically, you could see words, stories are critical to me, because I think they carry things. If you can come up with the right word, even in conversation, not in fancy writing or anything, you can help convey something much better than not having the right word. And I think stories are often what link us together. So if you can't explain something, or if you can't be literal about something, you know, life isn't just a list. But often if you can tell a story, you can explain things that sometimes you don't even understand. And I think growing up, my father was very specific about English as she should be spoken. On the other side, I also found out, which is displayed in the book, people use words to disguise, and they can camouflage things. So better if you do have a good understanding, because, you know, sometimes if a word sounds wrong, you know, something's afoot here. Particularly when my father was very ill, of course, all these analogies come, you know. No one's going to say your father's sick, he's not having a good day, or then, you know, once your father dies, you know, he left a little early. So yet, what the hell does all this stuff mean? And I think word stories, the way people use words, not just the words themselves, if you can keep an ear to that, even if the words are saying one thing, the way they're being said is telling you something else. So I think from an early age, I was very aware of not just the content, but the delivery. And best, if you want to really know what's going on, that you pay attention to both of those. And I think that just was germane from an early age.
And over and above of that world of sort of words and stories and books, there are also the dogs in the book. You want to say something about the dogs?
I love animals, and I've always been the pet guy. So again, very lucky in Hillbrow, the first few years in the apartment, flat as we called it then, no pets were allowed. And again, going back to a world where there's no social media or whatever, and if you're a bit lonely and you're living in a flat, particularly come the holidays, you know, you can read or you can listen to the radio, you can go for a walk, but it's a bit weird if you're this, you know, 11-year-old just walking by yourself. The moment you have a dog, you have a purpose, and you're in a way off the hook. So when I finally, I think it was about 10, when I found at the bottom of a Christmas tree, the lid on a shoebox was moving, and opened it, and there was a little spaniel. And Pal became so much more. I mean, obviously he was a pet, but I could get out now. I had literally a pal. So besides being all those normal things that people would say about loving animals and, you know, bonding and all that sort of thing, Pal also allowed me to exit my box, and I walked 4 miles, but it was absolutely fine. No one was, what's going on? The boy is walking his dog. And then when you go to the park, you know, as sort of the cliche, people come up, they pat the dog, then they talk to you a little bit, so you feel a little bit, if you're a bit lonely, it's quite nice to have someone chatting to you about your dog and therefore about you. So Pal was very, very instrumental in kind of releasing me, I guess, from a bit of loneliness. And you know, from ever since then, I mean, I have 3 dogs and 4 cats at home. So it's stayed.
Yeah, and it's quite obvious that it's important to young Finn as well to have a dog, because, you know, it's like liberating his life. It changes his life. I think that tell me about the characters that you find in the book, Uncle Ed, and the grandmother, and all those people. The girl who works in the building society, isn't there? Yeah. I mean, tell me about those characters. Are they like, I mean, where did they come from? Are they based on people that you remember? Are they assemblages?
All people. So Uncle Ed was my Uncle Jimmy. He was a wonderful guy, but a complete, terribly well-mannered, wonderful-hearted guy, but could never do anything. So he just was always waiting to help and very rarely did. He was in love with my mother, but he literally did get pushed aside by my dad during the Second World War. So, but he hung around for 40 years. You know, just, hey, I'm still here, I'm still here. Wonderful man, but, you know, that was Uncle Ed. I did have a Scottish grandmother. It wasn't quite as large as I make out in the book, but she was, you know, Calvinistic. You don't mess with her. She arrived in South Africa in 1922, the day she gave birth to my mom. No nonsense, that absolute Protestant work ethic. If you don't have any money, well then, you go without. What's your point? You work hard and you make sure that at any stage your sort of conscience is completely clear. Calvinistic time to the power of 10. Didn't really understand sympathy, but at the same time was very sort of loving in this strict way. So I'd go, what's wrong with you? Stop being silly. But then bring me a cup of tea without saying anything. So very, very, I guess that Dour Scott. Who else do you want to talk about? Well, we got all of them. Yeah. They're all real. We had my best friend at the time, or for a while, Varkas Papadimitropoulos. Really annoyed the hell out of me because I was a skinny kid, and I don't know what his Greek guys. He just seemed so much more muscular. And I don't know. He just had so much. Everything I didn't have, he had. So he's confident. He was a much better soccer player than me. Mediterranean, good looks. Skinny little white guy with pale and, you know. So Varkas was the kind of guy I wanted to be, but never, ever had the self-confidence to even get close. But all of those people are real. And that was the joy of even the Leb at school. Crazy guy, you know. You don't mess with the Lebs. And you don't mess with an 11-year-old Leb either. Because at that stage, they came from predominantly from Mayfair. They were part of a gang. They weren't scared. They weren't scared of teachers because, you know, you just teacher might find his car disappears that weekend kind of thing. So, and that was the joy of Hillbrow because cosmopolitan in terms of country and cosmopolitan in terms of style, a little bit of a WASPy. The girl who worked in the building society stayed two floors above me and she had a bit of a dubious reputation. Because she was very pretty and wore very short miniskirts, and that was the time where you could also go braless. So I remember that very well. But she was a honey. Yeah. She was always, you know, chatting to me and whatever, but had what my grandmother called it, more friends than she had nights. Can interpret that whichever way you wish. So she was the first, I guess, if you want to put them in segments of the, you know, the me generation, the I'm not going to be barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen, very good looking gal, but scandalous from, say, my grandmother's point of view. You know, you come from Scotland in the 20s and now you've got this charlatan, this harlot.
So, and then into this wonderful, super realist sort of middle class life enters Hebe, which is exactly the opposite of all these other characters that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little about the Hebe without spoiling
it? Without giving
it
away too much. So, again, it's very difficult to understand. I would go to the park almost every day with my dog. And in those days, you could have quite a lot of, we didn't call them homeless, they were hobos. And the hobo, there were quite a few of them, particularly in summer, they'd leave Durban and come up to Joburg. And they would be sitting on benches, and provided they didn't, they were, you know, obviously badly dressed and whatever, but provided they didn't cause any problems, the parkie.
All white.
Yeah. The parkie, as we call it, we just let them, you know, you can lie and sleep there, but come 5 o'clock, off you go. So provided they didn't do any major, you know, cause any problems, they could lie with a newspaper on their head and snooze all day, or occasionally dip their feet in the kiddies' pool. Quite different now, I suppose. And because I went to the park so often, I would talk a lot to these, or they would come and chat to me, and there was no kind of creepiness about it. It was just, you know, and some of them smelt and some of them didn't, and they would tell me a bit of their life story. Most of them were alcoholics. Some of them recovered. But by and large, you know, not aggressive, not nasty. Some were maybe a little bit cuckoo, but not in a scary sense. So Hebe is a bit of a combination of all those people I used to talk to. And some were, I mean, you could see they'd fallen on hard times, and their past was, you know, they were very articulate, smart. You could see through the grime they were very educated, et cetera, et cetera. Some were, you know, a little bit more full of nonsense. So I just thought of all those people and kind of created one.
And yet Hebe is not any of those things that you just said.
Yeah.
He's not untidy, he's like an urban angel that appears in the story, and he's one of the more interesting characters in recent South African literature for me. This magical person who comes and provides guidance to this young child. It's quite an extraordinary thing. How did you imbue him with those sort of, I hope I'm not ruining the book for everybody, but how did you imbue him with those magical qualities?
I think the
wisdom.
I think he was, in retrospect, the person I wish I could have had at that moment in time. I think because you had a, as the book displays, you know, everyone is trying really hard, and uncles and grandmothers and whatever, trying to sort of get you through this tough period, but they don't. They're very, very middle class, very say what you meant to say, hide any problems. So I probably didn't really get much help. I went to Sunday school and church, but that didn't really fill a gap. And I think in retrospect, that's what I would like to have had. I'd like to have had this kind of guy.
Yeah. And yet, I mean, as I listen to you, I really start feeling sorry for Finn. And yet the book is not about Finn being sorry for himself. It is about, he finds a magic and almost a redemption, a redemptive moment at the end of the book that is just so magical. And the book ends with the most beautiful letter written by this young child. And he just like pulls the whole book together in a wonderful way. And for those of you who haven't read it, it is an extraordinary book. One is always nervous to sort of look at a friend's book or review a friend's book or blurb a friend's book. And yet I read this and I was one of the first people who spoke in public about it. And after the launch, I thought, wow, bit of an oversell. And I'm glad that I didn't. You know, the critics also picked it up on it and the readers picked up on it. It's been reprinted and reprinted. So, you know, those of you who haven't read it, it's quite a wonderful book. And maybe that's a good place to stop the discussion. I would now like to offer you a chance. Any questions? Do we have a mic down here? Okay, can you speak without a mic?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, okay.
Don't get afraid. First of all, John, I would really like to thank you from the bottom of my heart for gracing us this afternoon with your presence and your wisdom. I would like to start with a question. I would like to know more about John, the person, because we've spoken a lot about John, the writer. Now, in my view, I know John Hunt from Hunter's Carters. You won almost all the advertising prizes that could have been won. The picture I've got in my mind, historically, is whenever John Hunt is there, it's either money or prizes. So I've got three questions in one. Number one, if you had to write a story about your own life, what would the title of it be? Number two, which book had the biggest influence in your life? And the last part, which books have you given away to other people most?
Wow.
Is he allowed to ask them?
The first question, if I were to write a book about myself genuinely, it would be something like Still Working It Out, or My Life So Far, or something. You know, it doesn't feel to me in any way as if it's concluded. So I don't know if that's sort of just kind of, you know, you get to some level and then maybe something else opens and some, so maybe that's it. The second question was, which book influenced me the most? Again, difficult to give one, because I think also when you're reading the book, in that moment of your life, that book impacts you a lot. So it's terrible because a lot of people would say this, there's sort of a set of books that opened me up, starting with probably reading books that I didn't quite understand, but getting paragraphs and being excited by it, sort of opening my mind a little bit more, even if I wasn't too sure. And by the time I was 15, 16, 17, I was probably reading books that maybe it was a little bit old for me and still not fully understanding it. But and the one that absolutely caught me at that time, I think I was about 15, was Catcher in the Rye, which is very famous and a little bit, almost as you say it, a lot of the cognoscent, you might go, oh my God, it's not that classic. I mean, it's sort of the coming of age thing. But for me, when I think it was second last year at high school, it just, the story and where I was, and just boom. So that's always been held up. But then I read a lot of Steinbeck, and all of his books. I sort of then got mad after reading Catcher in the Rye, and I think I read five Steinbecks in a row, because that was the next thing. So if you're saying absolute effect, probably the Catcher in the Rye and the Steinbecks as a developing guy that really just stuck with me. And then the third question was?
Books that you've given most away to your friends or family?
There's no one, but I give books away constantly. So that's my calling card. I read a book I like, and I immediately give it away. It's changed a little bit because so much is online now, and I much prefer old-fashioned. I much prefer, here's some paper with a cover. Read this thing and maybe write something in the front page. My wife kind of like mocks me. He liked this. Here we go again. Because I think reading and giving that story to someone, even if they only read it in 2 years' time, I don't know how to explain. So I once said to someone, if you really want to know someone's Facebook profile, go and find out what the last 3 books are that they've read. And that, so I don't know if that sort of answers your question, but,
Any other questions?
What were the last 3 books that you read?
The Milkman, the one which is not a fiction story. It's a James Coetzee's, just got it all out on. What's it? It's, I'm trying to think of the title. It's essays, recent essays, which I don't normally read, but I started reading it and it's really helping. I mean, obviously he's genius, and to read about writing helps me. And the one before that was, again, someone's going to go, oh no, that's a bit of a cliche thing, is the one about the girl in England who's a bit of a sort of alcoholic. Elephant is fine, yes, that one. So I'm very eclectic. I don't get stuck on specifics. And I'm terrible because I travel quite a lot, and airport libraries, they see me coming.
Okay. It's interesting. I also read Steinbeck at that age, and when I went to America at the age of 21, I actually traveled to Cannery Row, which had the beginnings of a tourist attraction then. Are there any other questions? Thank you very much, John. Thank you very much for coming. I hope you enjoyed it. I had a wonderful time listening to you, and thank you very much.
Thank you all for your time. Yeah.